Welcome to the Lumbleson Center's podcast series on invention and innovation. I'm Laurel Fritsch, and on this episode, we'll explore Civil War technology in sea and skies. First, Jesse Heats, a graduate student at King's College London, will discuss Confederate use of ironclad ship technology. Then, Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum curator Tom Crouch will discuss experimental aircraft during the Civil War. So without further delay, here's Jesse.
The naval war in the Atlantic affected nearly every aspect of the war, from diplomacy and logistics to strategy and morale. Arguably, it was here that the Confederates were at their greatest disadvantage. On April 19, 1861, President Abraham Lincoln declared a blockade of the Confederate Atlantic and Gulf coasts from South Carolina to Texas. On April 27th, the blockade was extended to include the coasts of North Carolina and Virginia. The Union Navy was now charged with enforcing a blockade that encompassed 3,500 miles of coastline. At this point, the Union Navy possessed roughly 45 vessels fit for service. To remedy this problem, Union Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles immediately ordered the construction of 8 sloops, 23 gunboats, and 12 double-ended paddle steamers. Welles quickly recalled all Union Navy ships from foreign stations and began an unparalleled process of purchasing nearly all available ships. By December of 1861, the Union Navy had swelled threefold to some 264 vessels. The recently established Confederate Navy found itself in an entirely more precarious situation. The day that Stephen Mallory became the Confederate Secretary of the Navy, the Confederate Navy had a mere 10 ships, mounting a total of 15 guns. Mallory clearly had his work cut out for him if the Confederates were to challenge the Union blockade. Southern leaders, including Mallory, understood that the Confederacy would be short on supplies, and therefore, it was of absolute necessity that it needed to defeat or otherwise subvert the Union blockade so that contact could be maintained with the outside world. Confederate President Jefferson Davis and others largely neglected the importance of the naval war and wholeheartedly threw their support behind the use of the ancient technique of privateering. While Mallory also coveted attacks on enemy commerce, he embraced an entirely different strategy, one that became the crux of his naval policy planning. Mallory, well aware of the advancements in ironclad technology that were taking place in Europe, realized that the Union's neglect of this technology provided the Confederate Navy with a possible edge. On May 10, 1861, Mallory, who had already dispatched Confederate agents throughout the South, Europe, and even the North in search of ships to purchase, wrote of the importance of the Confederate Navy's rapid adoption of ironclads. Quote, "I regard the possession of an iron-armored ship as a matter of the first necessity. Such a vessel at this time could traverse the entire coast of the United States, prevent all blockades, and encounter, with fair prospect of success, their entire navy. If to cope with them upon the sea we follow their example and build wooden ships, we shall have to construct several at one time, for one or two ships would fall an easy prey to her comparatively numerous steam frigates. But only inequality of numbers may be compensated by invulnerability. And thus, not only does economy but naval success dictate the wisdom and expediency of fighting iron against wood, without regard to first cost. Naval engagements between wooden frigates, as they are now built and armed, will prove to be the forlorn hopes of the sea, simply contests in which the question, not of victory, but of who shall go to the bottom first, is to be solved. Should the committee deem it expedient to begin at once the construction of such a ship, not a moment should be lost," end quote. Even with such a sensible argument, Confederate leadership was relatively slow to embrace the idea of incorporating ironclads into the Confederate Navy. Yet Mallory persevered, and after several months of lobbying, the Confederate Congress in the late spring of 1861 allocated $2 million to purchase European-constructed ironclads. Although the venture was unsuccessful, it marked the direction in which the Confederate Navy was heading, towards the embrace of iron. There was another reality that motivated Confederate naval planners to adopt ironclads, the recent revolution in naval gunnery. The superior firepower of forts had routinely bested wooden-hulled sailing ships, yet the landscape changed with the advent of steam power and the widespread adoption of new naval ordnance. Larger guns and the increased range from rifle guns and explosive shells could readily destroy earthworks. All of this limited the effectiveness of land-based fortifications against warships. As such, it could not be assumed that the Confederate fortifications could hold out against the rapidly increasing Union fleet. The Union capture of Forts Clark and Hatteras in July of 1861 proved that a naval solution was required if Union warships were to be kept out of Confederate harbors. If the lofty goals of the Confederate naval strategy wasn't a difficult enough objective for Mallory to achieve, it soon became a tremendous uphill climb given the limitations of the South's capacities to build a wooden fleet, much less one composed of iron. From the outset, the Confederacy suffered from shortages of timber, hemp, processed iron, gunpowder, and perhaps most importantly, skilled labor. To make matters worse, the South had little in the way of shipbuilding infrastructure. Other issues plagued Mallory's attempt to construct a formidable iron fleet. Logistically, the South was a mess. Poverty in states' rights facilitated the inability of the limited Confederate central government to swiftly acquire the necessary supplies for the development of a navy. Even if supplies were found, the Army's needs generally took precedence, which included the prized commodity of manpower. Another problem lay in the transport of supplies. Only 10 southern ports had adequate rail connections to the interior. The other primary mode of southern transportation relied on coastal steamers and schooners, which were by then targeted by the Union Navy. The Confederates struck a tremendous victory for their naval development when the Union abandoned Norfolk, leaving behind valuable resources that the Confederate Navy put to good use. Wasting little time, the Confederates began grafting iron plates to the salvaged hull of the Merrimack. The endeavor strained the capacities of the Tredegar Iron Works to produce 2 layers of 2-inch thick iron plate. The Merrimack was quickly rechristened CSS Virginia. She had 4 inches of iron plate covering her 178-foot long and 24-foot tall above the water superstructure. She had 1-inch plate covering her 264-foot hull down to 3 feet below the waterline. She mounted 10 guns and an iron ram. Her broadsides were composed of 6 9-inch smoothbores and 2 6-inch smoothbores. She also had 2 7-inch rifle guns, 1 fore and 1 aft. The Virginia did have flaws. Her underpowered and unreliable engines could only attain top speeds of around 5 knots, and it took her about half an hour to make a 180-degree turn. Her draft exceeded 20 feet, making her unsuitable for shallow water, yet her weight and poor maneuverability made her relatively unfit for blue water operations. However, even with such flaws, she was among the most powerful warships in the world. Confederate naval hopes laid squarely on the effectiveness of the Virginia against her traditionally constructed Union foes. On March 8, 1862, the Virginia and her support ships steamed down the Elizabeth River toward the Union blockading squadron, the Cumberland, the Congress, the Minnesota. The Cumberland was rammed and quickly sank, nearly taking the Virginia with it. The Congress was ordered to run aground in order to prevent being rammed and sunk. The Virginia's fire quickly forced her surrender. The Minnesota had inadvertently run aground and was a sitting duck. However, Virginia retired for the evening, planning on returning the following day to finish off the stranded Union frigate. Southern newspapers heralded the first day's events as a harbinger of future Confederate naval success. They predicted the raising of the blockade, an attack on Washington, D.C., destruction of New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and even envisioned the Virginia ending the war. Members of Lincoln's cabinet may very well have shared a similar opinion. Upon hearing the news of Virginia's success during the first day, against the finest ships of the Union Navy, Secretary of War Edwin Stanton stated, quote, "We shall have a cannonball from one of her guns in the White House before we leave this room," end quote. When the Virginia returned the following morning, alongside the Minnesota sat the USS Monitor, a little single turret ironclad that looked like a cheese box on a raft. The two ironclads battered each other for over 2 hours at ranges between 30 and 200 yards, with little effect. Both vessels mutually disengaged, with Virginia heading back to Norfolk. For the following 2 months, the Virginia and Monitor uneasily eyed one another, neither side willing to risk the loss of their most valuable weapon. On the 10th of May, 1862, the Confederate Army withdrew from Norfolk, leaving Virginia to fend for itself. With a draft too deep to navigate the rivers, Confederate Flag Officer Josiah Tatnall gave the order to destroy her in order to prevent her capture. Early on the morning of May 11th, she was set afire, and at 4:58 a.m., the fire reached her magazine and blew her apart. The loss of the Virginia was a tremendous blow to the Confederacy in every conceivable way. Former Confederate naval officer turned historian J. Thomas Scharf called the ship's loss, quote, "the most distressing occurrence of the war up to that time," end quote. Such a statement is quite significant, as by that time, the Confederates had suffered a devastating loss at Shiloh and had lost their largest port, New Orleans. Virginia provided the Confederate Navy a fleeting glimmer of hope, and its loss posed serious tactical and strategic setbacks. It had smashed a hole in the Union blockade, struck fear into the Union Navy, and had made the James River inaccessible to Union forces. Its presence had delayed McClellan's Peninsula campaign, and its absence allowed Union vessels to advance and later cover the withdrawal of McClellan's army, possibly saving it from destruction. Aside from the battlefield implications that arose as a consequence of the Virginia's destruction, there was a deep psychological impact on the whole of the South. They had been hypnotized by the possibilities of the ship, only to lose it, all while the Union ratcheted up its own ironclad production. After the loss of their prize ship, things worsened for the Confederacy on a diplomatic level, which had considerable implications for its war effort. Britain's attitude towards intervention on the side of the South cooled off significantly. This was undoubtedly a serious blow to the Confederate Navy. It had long sought relief in helping to check the Union naval stranglehold, either directly or indirectly. By 1863, Britain was so committed to remaining neutral that it seized the famed Laird rams, two powerful ironclad rams constructed in Birkenhead, intended for service in the Confederate Navy. For the procurement of ironclads, the Confederacy was now on its own. The Confederate Navy did just that, wholeheartedly continuing to construct its own force of ironclads of varying shapes and sizes. It had several fleeting successes. The first ironclad rams, CSS Palmetto State and Chicora, devastated the Union squadron blockading Charleston Harbor. CSS Albemarle drove off Union squadron at Plymouth, which threatened Union control of the area, and aided in the Confederate capture of Plymouth. The monstrous CSS Tennessee held promise in holding Mobile Bay, but foolishly chased Farragut's fleet into deep water, allowing itself to be surrounded and disabled. The CSS Arkansas found success on the Mississippi, but after sustaining significant damage, she was destroyed to prevent capture. The Confederate Navy tried mightily to construct an ironclad force that could lift the Union blockade and defend southern harbors. Yet it was industrially, politically, financially, and material strained to such an extent that such a goal could not be achieved in any substantial or lasting way. Some 50 ironclads had been laid down, but only 22 were ever completed. In fact, a vast majority of the ironclads laid down in 1862 were not ready until 1864. By that time, the Union had some 71 ironclads, 671 vessels in total, at her disposal. By then, the Southern war effort was in poor shape. Its ports had been choked off, and its ironclads were often sent off in small groups against a vastly superior Union force only to be lost, or contained to a harbor as the Union encircled the Confederate army, or were simply destroyed to prevent Union capture. They were never plentiful or versatile enough to allow the Confederacy to take advantage of amphibious operations, which the Union regularly made extensive use of, a strategically fatal flaw. Perhaps the best summation of the efforts of the Confederate Navy and its ironclads to compete with the Union came from the post-war statement of Stephen Mallory, who said, quote, "I am satisfied that, with the means at our control, and in view of the overwhelming force of the enemy at the outset of the struggle, our little Navy accomplished more than could have been looked or hoped for. And if I have ever felt any surprise connected with its operation, it was that we accomplished so much. Our Navy alone kept those of the United States from reaching Richmond by the James River and from reaching Savannah and Charleston, and yet not 10 men in 10,000 in the country knew or appreciated these facts."
During the holiday season of 1864, the Army of Northern Virginia was pinned in a growing set of entrenchments at Petersburg, the last bastion between the Army of the Potomac and the capture of Richmond. But at this dark moment in the history of the Confederacy, quote, "There appeared on our lines a man who proposed to build a machine to navigate the air, carry shells, and drop them on the Northern armies and their cities. A comrade confirmed that their unit had attended a lecture given by Richard Oglesby Bird Davidson, who was circulating through the lines collecting the money with which to build his flying machine. In 6 days, he said, the Yankees could be defeated, and on the 7th, they would surrender." The men of the 7th, Virginia, concluded that Davidson was a crank and refused to contribute much. Other units proved more generous and more enthusiastic. The pressing need for reconnaissance had plagued the Army of the James, commanded by Benjamin Butler, chief engineer of the Army of the James. Colonel Edward Wellman Sorrell proposed a revolutionary solution. For some years, he'd been fascinated by the possibility of a rotary wing craft and had even prepared drawings of the reconnoiterer. He was inspired by small hand-launched helicopters, toys that had been given to children for generations. He actually built a fairly large model, about 20 feet, and launched it into the air and convinced Butler that this was an idea worth pursuing. He approved leave for Sorrell, who traveled to Philadelphia to raise money with which to build his experimental model. And by the time the war was over, he had actually built a considerable portion of the reconnoiterer. While Davidson was circulating through the Confederate lines, and Colonel Sorrell, money in hand, was beginning to cut metal in New York. Solomon Andrews was preparing to demonstrate a flying model of his Ariane in the halls of Congress in the library of the Smithsonian Institution. Having witnessed a test of a model of that craft, Joseph Henry, Secretary of the Smithsonian, an unofficial chief scientist of the United States, reported to Secretary of War Stanton that it was possible, quote, that Andrews can actually perform what he asserts he can do. That being the case, Henry and his committee recommended that the War Department fund the construction of Andrews' full-scale machine. What in the world convinced these inventors to take up a challenge with a view to the destruction of the enemy, a technological goal that most men and women still regarded as the very definition of the impossible? There are a whole string both of patents and of published flying machine proposals that you pick up during the war. But what I want to do is focus on just three of these plans. One of the interesting things in this whole business is when this is happening. Petersburg. As a nation is going down the tubes in military fashion, they are sometimes more willing to reach out for wonder weapons. And that may have been the case with these characters because so many of them were coming at the time of Petersburg, relatively late in the war. The first one is that of Richard Oglesby Davidson. Davidson is the guy who's circulating through Confederate camps. It doesn't change much between 1840, Davidson's first publication, and 1864, when he's trying to convince Confederate troops to give him the money with which to build the thing. It's pretty much an ornithomorphic machine. He actually has a window in the front, a window in the back, and a window on each side. To nose down, he opens the window in front. To nose up, he opens the window in back and side to side. It looked kind of as silly to his contemporaries as it does to us today. And he's typical of the earliest kind of winged flying machine dreamers who really have no grasp on technical reality, who just have this dream and the desire to explore it. When the war actually begins, Davidson, he enlisted as a trooper. He was discharged about 9 months later with severe rheumatism, but he won't let go of the flying machine idea. There's an indication in Richmond newspapers from 1863 that he'd actually built a fairly large model of the thing in a Richmond lumber yard and was testing it on the back of a locomotive. He goes to the Confederate government and tries to get official support to build the machine. And of course, he's rejected. And it's at that point that he decides to go straight to the soldiers themselves and get the money from them. He is occasionally successful. We have records of his actually collecting several thousand dollars as he circulates through the camps around Petersburg. Some commanders absolutely boot him out. And he disappears at the end of the war without having obviously flown this thing or anything like it. Edward Wellman Sorrell is on the other side of the lines. Sorrell was an Englishman, came to America as a young man, and was trained as an engineer. He was a serious professional engineer in Civil War era terms. While working as an engineer in New York in the 1850s, a group of Philadelphians came to him and asked him to investigate an inventor who claimed that he had a helicopter flying machine, as so many of these are. And Sorrell was impressed. Along comes the war, and it's not until 1864, when Sorrell's chief engineer of the Army of the James, that he brings the notion to Benjamin Butler. He actually conducts rotary wing tests in the field. What looks like the balloon is actually just the fuselage. There's a crew of three inside, This is a wing. There's a steam engine inside and two props, one at the front, one in the back, and propellers, two each, top and bottom. So Butler thinks enough of it to approve Sorrell's leave. Sorrell goes to Philadelphia, raises money. The war ends before he's completed the machine, and he is pretty quickly in correspondence with European flying machine leaders. And ultimately, he comes to see that this is, quite literally, never going to get off the ground. And he finally walks away from it. The last of our three is Solomon Andrews. His father was a minister, and it was while sitting through one of his father's duller sermons, looking out the window at the eagle flying outside, that he came up with the notion for his Aerion. He establishes an inventor's institute in Hoboken in the 1840s, raises money, and actually builds one of these aerostats that early on. It is a lighter-than-air machine. His notion is that steam engines are just too heavy to power flying machines. So he's come up with the notion of using what airship people in the 20th century called dynamic lift. If you have a balloon, it just goes straight up because it's fairly aerodynamic. Andrew's notion was that if you forget a round free balloon, if you build something like this, those envelopes, those cigar-shaped things are all filled with hydrogen, that's going to have resistance to vertical motion going up and down. Then by angling those envelopes, you can propel yourself forward or backward or turn in either direction. And he actually does it, tests it, and then walks away from it. He is a physician, so during the war, he enlists first with the Sanitary Commission and then with the Army of the Potomac as a surgeon. And it's during the Peninsula Campaign when he sees Thaddeus Lowe's balloon corps in operation, and he regards the balloons as an absolute failure, that he comes back to the notion of actually building one of his Aerions for the United States government. So he writes to President Lincoln directly, and Lincoln sends his plan and letters and all of that to the topographical engineers, who absolutely reject him. So Andrews has a French company build a model. He brings it to Washington, so first in the basement of the Capitol, and then in the library of the Smithsonian Institution. This is the model that he actually demonstrates. And what he proves is that initially, at least for a few minutes, he can make the thing climb, descend, and actually fly in a circular pattern. Andrews, of course, is saying this is going to be a much more successful reconnaissance device than Lowe's tethered balloons. Robert Shank, the head of one of the military affairs committees, is one of Andrews' supporters, and he's the one who arranges that test at the Smithsonian Institution. He has an official committee created who watch Andrews' demonstration, are impressed, and in fact suggest that the government ought to support him to the extent of paying for a technology demonstrator. The war is so close to being at an end that he doesn't get his money. Rather than walking away, he actually creates an airship company. He actually builds something that's a little cheaper than the three-hull version, and he actually makes two flights with it. And on those two flights, he actually is able to maneuver to some extent. The problem, of course, is that in order to maneuver, he has to have vertical motion to make himself turn. And he can only get vertical motion by A, valving gas from his bag, or B, dropping ballast. And it's a trade-off between the amount of gas you have left and the amount of ballast you have left, which says that while he actually might have been able to fly over Confederate lines with one of these things, it would have been something that could only stay in the air for a very short period of time. What are we to make of all of this? Some of these people, as I said, like Davidson, are old-style flying machine dreamers who dream technological dreams before all of the relevant pieces are in place. Others, however, are actually part of the mainstream of developing aeronautics. And Solomon Andrews is right in the technological mainstream when it comes to airship development. And Sorrell is right in the mainstream when it comes to heavier-than-air flying machine development. Far from being totally rejected by professional engineers in the 19th century, flying machines had actually intrigued them. 40 years before the required technologies are going to slip into place. And so I think when you look at these guys, they do say something to you about the power of vision and dreams and so on and so forth in the history of technology. And again, the extent to which 19th century engineers shared at least one of those visions, the vision for a flying machine.
So that concludes this episode on Civil War technology. You can share any thoughts you have about this episode with us by email at LELCEN@si.edu, on Facebook at facebook.com/Lemelson Center, and on Twitter at twitter.com/SI_invention with a capital I. Please join us for our next podcast, and in the meantime, keep up with us on our website where you'll find blogs, video podcasts, and more. Thanks for listening.